You're listening to The Plug with Neil Griffiths.
We are officially rolling. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of The Plug Podcast with me, Neil Griffiths. Thank you so much, as always, for tuning into this week's episode. If you haven't already, check us out on all social channels, Instagram, YouTube, Threads, at theplug.podcast to stay up to date with all the action happening on the show. I'm so excited for this week's episode. I'm joined by one of my favorite actors and now favorite authors. My guest this week is actor, director, producer, and now New York Times best-selling author Ben McKenzie. After shooting to fame in the early 2000s as Ryan Atwood on one of the greatest shows of all time, The OC, fight me on this, it is one of the best shows of all time. Ben went on to achieve massive success on TV, fronting shows like Southland and later Gotham. However, out of work during the COVID pandemic, Ben's talents took a new direction after his friend suggested he invest in cryptocurrency. Having secured an economics degree prior to his acting career taking off, Ben went down the rabbit hole to investigate, and 2 years later, has deemed the crypto industry the largest Ponzi scheme in history, with his new book, Easy Money, Cryptocurrency, Casino Capitalism, and the Golden Age of Fraud, which is out right now. Ben joined the show this week to talk about his introduction to the crypto world, interviewing some major players in the space, including now indicted FTX founder Sam Bankman-Fried, and how he dealt with the praise and criticism of a Hollywood name taking on crypto. I've been such a huge fan of Ben's on-screen work since I was a teenager, and I had such a blast sitting down with him to talk about how his investigation and book are shining a new and harrowing light on the cryptocurrency industry. Ben McKenzie joins me right now on The Plug Podcast. All right, I'm so excited to welcome my guest right now, actor, producer, director, and now officially New York Times bestselling author, Ben McKenzie. Ben, thanks for coming on, man.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We spoke for about a minute and a half before. We're wearing the same shirt, it looks like, which is mildly embarrassing, I think, for both of us, but that's okay.
Who wore it better? You look good.
Mine looks newer, if I'm honest. Yours is a bit faded.
I'll be honest. You do. Yeah. Yours looks, I feel like I probably need to get a new green shirt for our next, my next time on the podcast.
I've been watching a lot of interviews you've been doing over the last few months, and probably 12 months, to be honest, of like really going hard at this. The book Easy Money has now been out for just under 2 weeks. I said New York Times bestselling list. Congratulations, man. How do you celebrate being a New York Times bestselling author?
Well, my wife and I go out, we have a nice dinner and, you know, maybe a few drinks. We threw a lovely book party, for it. Yeah. I don't know. It's not like a Hollywood premiere. There's no huge red carpet press line, you know, it's a lot of this, a lot of Zooms, some in-person, press. But it's really satisfying. I mean, you know, I've spent 2 years of my life on this. So for it to come out and kind of immediately get some attention I feel very lucky. And I also feel very grateful for the folks out there that have bought the book. So thank you for buying it and reading it and liking it. That's how books spread through word of mouth. Not, you know, I'm the marketing campaign. There is no $100 million behind me or whatever. It just kind of is what it is.
Yeah. Do you feel more pretentious now?
Yes. Yeah, well, I aspire to be more. I am, sure. I think, sufficiently pretentious, but I do aspire for more. I have ordered a beret, a holder for my cigarettes.
I wanted. I'm disappointed you didn't show up to this with a pipe, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, tweed jackets in the summer in Brooklyn is a bold statement, but you know, I think I can pull it off. I'm not exactly sure what a successful author is supposed to act like, but I'm pretty sure I'm not going to be able to pull it off. So I'll just keep doing what I'm doing and reinvent the wheel.
Yeah. All the interviews I've seen, admittedly, were happening probably before Easy Money came out. So again, as we're recording, this has been out for all of 13 days.
Yeah.
How has the reaction been on your end from both peers and just random people contacting you?
It's been great. I mean, I think so many people were waiting for a book that could describe crypto to them in a way that they could understand, because, you know, for all of its sort of for how successful it was in drawing people in, it's still about 80% of the country that didn't buy crypto. And whenever I talk to folks that didn't, they almost always say the same thing, which is, I don't know, it seems so complicated, but also a little bit scammy. And I'm like, no, it's not that complicated. It is scammy. You're fine. So I kind of wrote the book, well, with two audiences in mind. The first is folks that didn't buy it and just want to know what the hell went on and what all that fuss was about, and tell that story in kind of an entertaining way where, you know, it can be an enjoyable read. Econ is such a pain in the ass kind of a specialty, because economists are notoriously, like, they're just not great communicators, in my opinion. They're sort of condescending. The economics has this language which is like English adjacent. It's like sort of English, but not quite English. And so I wanted to kind of, like, you know, distill a lot of sort of economic fundamentals into a readable form. And then I also wanted to write for folks that have bought it, most of whom have lost money. Like, if you want to kind of understand how this thing worked, in my opinion, how it does work, you know, this will allow you to educate yourself if you want to be. So the reaction's been great. I mean, you know, I know it's working because the crypto bros are very, very mad at me, and I'm getting bombarded with hateful tweets or zeets or whatever we're calling them now. So I know it's working.
It's funny because my brother-in-law is a financial advisor, and from day dot, he was like, this is dumb, it's complicated. But what you just said, bang on, he would try to explain to me. So I was like, oh, I'm sure, whatever you're saying, whatever, I don't care. But another friend, and this is why I want to tell you this story, like 30 seconds or less, he is another guy who has historically been great with money. It would have been like late 2021. And he said, if you're not in Bitcoin, you're an idiot. And I was like, okay, sure, whatever. A couple hundred bucks wasn't a big deal. I did some light Googling. All the articles were like, oh, this one is about to boom. So it was Polkadot, by the way. This is about to boom. It's going to be great. And I was like, sure, it's a couple hundred bucks, whatever. 6 months, nothing happens. And I was like, this is not what I was told. And then after that, it just dropped dramatically. I think I got about like 20% back of my money. I'm like, this is stupid. And I even looked at, like, even getting ready for this interview this morning, there was an article about Polkadot again saying, what was the actual headline? It was, the quote was, it's on the success path to boom and 100 times price growth. That was this morning. When you were getting into this, and I know that your kind of interest peaked when a friend said, hey, you should get into this. Was it a similar thing when you started looking into it? Everything seemed to be positive and...
Exactly. I mean, and that's such a big tell, right? Like, if you just searched, you know, crypto, or I was originally looking for a podcast, you know, to try to kind of listen to regular people explain this stuff to me, all of the crypto podcasts were all trying to sell you crypto. You know, all of the ads were crypto ads. They usually had referral codes. So, you know, the hosts were referring you to this or that cryptocurrency, either an actual currency or a supposed currency or an exchange or some service. And they were going to get paid based on how many people they referred, right? That's the referral code thing, right? And so immediately your sensors go off and you think, well, first of all, nothing can be all good. It just doesn't exist in the real world.
100 times price growth sounds amazing, to be fair.
Yeah, sure, exactly. But, like, obviously sort of absurd the claim gets, the more clear it is absurd, right? Sure. 1,000 times, 10,000 times, 100,000 times price growth, right? Yeah. Like, at a certain point, you're just talking about sort of what seems on the realm, you know, within some loose realm of possibility versus what just is obviously complete bollocks. I think that's one of the tells sort of when I came into crypto, was just how much they were sort of using psychology, basic human psychology. People always want to make money. Get rich quick schemes are as old as money itself. But it was cloaked in this language of sort of financial emancipation, financial innovation. Blockchain technology was discussed a lot, you know, which was this thing where I was, what is blockchain? And then to discover that blockchain's been around for over 30 years and is yet to really be used for anything other than gambling, which is effectively what crypto is, and criminal activity, makes you think, well, I'm pretty sure the innovation story is not really quite true. So it, yeah, it was just started with things like that. But the marketing was definitely, it was so over the top that you sort of, I mean, I think I was not alone, and it sounds like you are there now, like to think, this can't possibly be true. At the time though, when everything's going up, it's very easy to sell that story. It's when things are going down that it becomes harder to sell the same story.
I guess it was the pandemic as well kind of accelerated that. Like I said, when I kind of got involved in the conversation, it would have been like mid to late 2021. So I think Australia at that time, we were still in lockdown. So I was kind of like, all right, sure, we'll do that. But is it true that this really started for you? Was the friend conversation before or after you were at like a bar in Brooklyn watching a Dodgers game and the Matt Damon Fortune Favors the Brave ad came on? What was the timeline there?
Yeah, the friend of mine had come to me earlier that year in 2021. Right. And so that had piqued my curiosity. I then approached a journalist in August of that year, Jacob Silverman, to pitch him on this crazy idea of writing a book. I didn't know how to write about events that hadn't happened yet. And he was about to go on parental leave and he was sort of keen to do it. So we started writing articles. And, you know, initially we made a little bit of a splash in the sense of sort of calling out my fellow celebrities for shilling crypto. But there was no indication that our message was really getting through. The market just kept going up and up and up. And so we were both fans of the Dodgers, the Los Angeles Dodgers baseball team. We gathered at a bar in Brooklyn, Jacob and I. We were just going to sit down and watch the game. And then Matt Damon's ad came on basically saying, if you don't buy crypto, you're a wimp. Fortune favors the brave. And there was nothing to be done. I mean, I just ordered another beer and just sat there going, you know,
only you and South Park have done anything with that Matt Damon ad. No one else. It was kind of like, oh, if Matt Damon's talking about it, then it must be legitimate, right? Like no one really thought anything of it.
Yeah. I mean, look, he definitely got mocked online a fair amount, but you're right. I mean, only the South Park guys did a great send up of all that stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, only my dumb ass was like, I'll write a whole book about, I was already on the journey though. You know, I was already there. So I was like, well, this will be a good scene for the movie or for the book and potentially a documentary when all you're looking for is a little bit of break, from the book. And all of a sudden you get Damon. Also the umpire's uniforms bore FTX labels, which I thought was kind of like,
yeah,
in your face, you know. The biggest exchange now bankrupt. One of the biggest exchanges now bankrupt was literally buying off the umps. Otherwise, you can't make this stuff up.
It's kind of the power of celebrity, both in a good and bad way, though, right? Bad in the sense of that Matt Damon thing, but like your book. I had Rainn Wilson on recently. I don't know if you've read his.
I listened to that. That was great. I haven't read his book yet, but I listened to your interview.
And he kind of told me that he had to use a lot of self-deprecating humor in the book because the assumption is he's an actor. Of course, he's best known as Dwight Schrute. Who the fuck is Dwight Schrute to tell us about trying to invoke a spiritual revolution? But that kind of breaks through because in the case with Easy Money, I feel like if you were just a random nobody who said crypto's corrupt, here's my book, you wouldn't get a lot of eyes on it. But people who might be fans of your work or know who you are more willing to listen. And to your That's point right. earlier on, like this book is so good and helpful to people who, in my case, if this came out 18 months ago, I would have told my friend to fuck off. Like, so there is like, that is the good side of it where you can use your status for good.
Yeah, I describe it as like, it'll get you the audition. You'll get in the room, right? I'll get enough people to pay attention to say, let's check it out. But at the end of the day, you still got to sing for your supper and you still got to write a book that people actually enjoy, want to read, learn from. So it's a, look, overall, it's a blessing because to be able to have a public profile means that people do pay attention to you. That being said, in a good way, it's not a get out of jail free card. It's not something that, you know, you can just fake like, you know, what you're talking about or not tell the story in a sort of a, you know, in a boring or ham-fisted way. And so, you know, I tried to lean on my skills that I developed in sort of showbiz to kind of say, all right, how can I tell the story as simply as possible? How can I tell it sort of through my eyes as a surrogate for the audience and demystify and deconstruct a lot of the myths around crypto in a way that's easy to understand, that's free a lot of the sort of like technobabble jargon, because crypto really does rely. It's funny. It's a little bit like that. Nigerian email scam thing where they write the language purposefully a little bit off as a way of sort of people are self-selecting into this group. Crypto is a little bit like that. There's this really overblown talk of sort of financial emancipation and distributed ledger technologies, and it gets very weird and kind of esoteric very quickly. It was just crucially important for me able to explain what that part of it is in terms of how it actually works, and then why it's baloney, and why actually the technology is not any, that's really just a smokescreen actually for what's going on, which is effectively, you know, it's very simple. You give your real money over to, you know, whatever exchange you bought Polkadot on or however you purchased it, you give your money to somebody else, your real money, and then they take that real money and, you know, maybe you get it back, maybe you don't. It's pretty simple, but you have to kind of start with, all right, I'll explain the technology to you, but now that I've explained it, you can forget it. It doesn't matter. Yeah. It's really not important. Yeah.
With context, we know you have a degree in economics. Was that ever a fear or a concern, say when you were working with Jacob or piecing this together? Because, you know, a lot of the articles are saying like former OC star talking about crypto, WTF. And it's like, does that piss you off? Or did you know that like there is going to be some eyes on me going, who is this guy? Why is he in here? Like, does he have any business talking about this subject?
Yeah, I think that initially it was a bit daunting because I didn't know what I was getting myself into. And I had a sense of strong suspicion that this was at best a bubble and at worst a bubble predicated on fraud. And I had a lot of reasons for that that were unrelated to the technology, of course. But then as I went further down the rabbit hole, I became more and more confident as the people that I talked to who did understand the technology, talking to cryptographers, talking to computer scientists, talking to programmers and software engineers and things like that, I realized that the majority of those professions also thought crypto was baloney. You know, if they didn't actually work in the industry, they were actually quite skeptical of it. And so I got more and more confident. At this point, when people sort of use, you know, something I've done in the past, let's say the OC is usually the thing. Oh, Ryan Atwood's telling me, you know, I should be worried about crypto. Obviously, he's dumb. I enjoy it. I mean, take this sort of perverse pleasure out of it because, first of all, you're paying attention. So I've gotten to you. Yeah. And secondly, it's good to be underestimated. It's really helpful. A lot of these crypto guys underestimated me, I think, in many ways. And that's what let me be in the room with them and record them so that I could put it in the book. Is they, I would assume, maybe I'm projecting this onto them, but I would assume they didn't think I was going to ask them, you know, very hard-hitting questions. Just a TV actor, what do I know? I think it's a great exercise in sort of trusting yourself and your instincts and being willing to take risk, something that all of us struggle with, I struggle with. I also struggle with sort of a sense of imposter syndrome, like in my regular profession as an actor, do I belong here? Can I still do this? Can I still, you know, produce? If I show up on set, am I gonna be able to perform? This was a great experience in trying something new, embracing that a sort of taming that fear, sort of looking at it straightforward and embracing it. And once you get on the other side, there's just this tremendous sort of sense of, it's sort of calming, you know, it's kind of calming. There's not much at this point that I can be attacked on that I don't have a defense for. At this point, I've heard all their arguments and I just deconstruct as many of them as I can in the book. So if people come at me with anger or some sort of condescension or belittling, I kind of take it more as what they're seeing, what they need to do in order to try to, you know, I mean, to me, it's a bit of a tell from them and it no longer really offends me. It's fascinating it's deeply rewarding because I've struggled with that for a long time. But to have produce something I'm very proud of and to have quite frankly been proven right here at this point, those defenses or those attacks just kind of, you know, fall by the wayside. I'm no longer susceptible to them.
Secret Sounds presents Harvest Rock, returning to Adelaide CBD on the 28th and 29th of October. See Jamiroquai and Beck for their only Australian shows, Nile Rodgers and Sheik, Ocean Alley, Paul Kelly, Bright Eyes, Sparks, Flight Facilities Decade DJ Set, Santa Gold, Chromeo, and so many more. Plus a new Yes Chef stage, delectable food offerings, and innovative bars. Music never tasted so good. Tickets go on sale on the 9th of August, and you can get yours by heading to harvestrock.com.
Was there a moment that you knew that you were officially on the map on this in a positive way? Like going back to that conversation you had with a friend asking you to invest in this, to being at a Senate hearing, testifying, I think, was it December last year? Was that a big moment where you were like, okay, this is no longer just an actor trying to find a hobby? Like you've cracked something here. You've brought it mainstream.
Yeah. I mean, look, testifying in front of the Senate in December, I had never testified in front of Congress before. Crypto was very much in the news then, as Sam Bankman-Fried had been arrested, I think, 2 days prior. But it was fascinating. It really felt like, DC is often described as kind of show business-esque in its presentation. And actually, it had elements of that where I felt like I knew the subject matter well, but I had been cast for the part by, committee members or their stabs who wanted someone who could kind of explain this to the American public. But I took that as a badge of honor, like a way, that I've sort of cut through alongside Jacob, cut through some of the, kind of obscure. Crypto has really survived because I think very few people had incentive to look at it very deeply who were not inside the industry and were not benefiting from it. I think most people who've invested had a similar experience to you where they put a little bit of money into it. They probably lost that money and they went, I learned my lesson, fine, once bitten, twice shy. And that's good. I mean, look, if that's the takeaway of most Americans, then, better that than to keep going back and to keep losing and to make matters worse. But that doesn't improve, our system's ability to sort of fight off these viruses from the outset. And so that's why I think, education and communication is so important. You have to communicate clearly in order to be understood. So as soon as I got the hearing, I felt like, I felt validated, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Well, then two of the major interviews that you did as well kind of put you on that space, like FTX founder Sam Bankman-Fried and Celsius CEO Alex Machinsky, right? Both of which, since you did those interviews, have been arrested. So yeah, maybe let's start with the interviews themselves. Were they hard to lock in, or were they really willing to have a conversation with you?
Well, the Alex Machinsky interview happened in the moment.
South by, right?
It was at South by Southwest last year. And I just walked onto the convention floor and he was seated in this open air kind of green room thing on the floor. And I recognized him and had a cameraman with me and mic'd up and went over and just introduced myself. And he was willing to chat. I don't think he really knew who I was. Yeah. He said, I walked up, with a lot of fear and sort of stuck out my hand and said, "Hey, Alex, my name's Ben." And he said, "Yeah, we met in Vegas." And I hadn't been to Vegas in like a decade, but my acting instincts took over. And I said, "Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, can we chat?" Just keep the improv going. We just sat down on a couch and chatted for, I forget how long that interview is. I want to say at least 45 minutes with a couple of his fellow Celsius employees. It's pretty wild how open this was. I think that's one of the things that's most disconcerting is how much people were able to get away with in broad daylight. Because Celsius was marketing itself as a crypto bank where you could give your crypto and earn this guaranteed return of like 18%, I think, at one point. That just screams red flags. Like, just, you can't guarantee an 18% return. Like, that's just, that's literally a red flag for a Ponzi scheme if you go to the SEC's website. And yet they'd been getting away with it, and Alex was quite confident. So that interview was just surreptitious. The interview with Sam, we just reached out to him. He started DMing us on Twitter, and we asked for an interview, and he agreed. So I still can't quite figure out what that is. I think it's some combination of sort of self-confidence and also rationalization. Like, I think a lot of guys, even in the upper echelons of crypto, even though they were only months away from getting charged with fraud, like, they really believed what they were saying, or had repeated it so often that it became second nature to them.
Yeah.
And so they didn't feel a fear of going in and being interviewed by someone who's potentially hostile to them. It's quite amazing. But that confidence is, it sort of runs hand in hand with being a con man, right? It's like you have this confidence, and you have to believe in your confidence in order to project that confidence. Yeah. So it becomes this, like, you know, inevitably you trip up at some point.
Where were you at in this journey when you, let's say Sam, for example, had you made up your mind about this industry? Did you go into this interview with a curiosity? Did you go in looking to do some sort of gotcha journalism? Like, did you know going in that this is all a mess and whatever that comes out of this guy's mouth, there's no way I'm coming out of that room going, oh, this makes a lot of sense?
Right. It was more, I would say the former, I looked at it this way, and I wrote the chapter. Let's start with all the clues that we have, right? All the red flags, all the different little pieces of information, and create, you know, as best we can, fill out our overall picture of Sam and his empire. And then, based on what we know about it, ask questions to try to learn more to sort of fill in the rest of it. My job was not there to sort of to do a gotcha thing where I, you know, you committed fraud, I know how you did it,
yeah.
Or allegedly. Like that's, I didn't have that information. That wasn't my goal. My goal was twofold. First was, if I've reached the top, or what's being marketed as the top of the industry, I mean, Sam really was the face of the industry by the time I interviewed him last year. You know, FTX Arena, the umpires' uniforms, Tom Brady, Giselle, you know, all of these famous people. The first goal was, like, can he explain crypto to me in a way I can understand? You know, if he's the top, then he's the guy that should be able to explain it to me. So that was the first goal. And the second was to poke on certain little, or pull on little threads that it sort of developed, try to understand exactly where the bodies might be buried, if they were buried, just kind of in a way read him. You know, yeah. Ask him some questions that weren't directly accusatory, but were more like, hey, what do you make of the fact that your company is in business with the stablecoin company Tether, and they have a fascinating, somewhat murky history and things like that. It's kind of took on like a detective-y type role, but without, it was more of the like, hey, come into the office and let's chat versus, you know,
I'm coming to
grill you. Yeah.
Because you
did you do this? Did you do that?
You forget the guy's only 31. Like, I'm 32. He's done a lot in a short period of time. Did he come off as charismatic or charming? Like, I think over the weekend we just saw that US prosecutors are worried that he's been influencing witness testimony. Did you get a sense that this guy, whether he's talking shit or not, he knows what he's doing, or at least trying to do?
I did get more of a sense of that. Yeah. I mean, my initial reaction from my impression of him from interviews was that he was kind of, the media was portraying him as this genius sort of wunderkind, quant, this guy that went to MIT, grew up at Stanford, you know, went to Jane Street, which is a Wall Street firm. And so it was so brilliant that he was able to make all of this money. And yet the way he dresses, the way he acts, he always wears a t-shirt, cargo shorts, sneakers, drives a Corolla.
Like, very, he was Adam trying Sandler. To kind of,
yeah, trying to do this sort of, you know, hey, I'm just like a regular guy kind of thing. Which I admit it was a pretty good, whether that was conscious or not, it sort of throws people off, right? They're not used to, he was supposedly one of the 100 wealthiest people in the world, according to Bloomberg, when I interviewed him. So, you know, you think of folks like that, and it's usually, you know, a guy in a suit and, you know, polished shoes and things like that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that didn't mean his demeanor and his behavior didn't mean that he wasn't capable of being, sophisticated when it came to sort of manipulation and or misleading people. And so I was very aware of sort of kind of his talking points, and I was trying to get him off of those talking points. And I found him, it felt empty to me often. It felt like he was sort of coming up with justifications and rationalizations for, forget the potential criminal activity, more just like the lack of usefulness, utility of crypto. Like, what did it really do? That was the sort of the thing where I felt the most empty, was trying to get him to name one company that did one thing that was actually good for the world. And he really struggled to do that.
Did he know he was struggling?
I think at certain points I detected some of that.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't just going to regurgitate, or I wasn't just going to accept whatever his first answer was. I was going to push back. You know, things like when I asked about his political donations, versus his charitable donations, because he really wanted to present himself as this altruist who was going to give all of his money away. And so he needed to earn money and to give it in order to give it away. But I knew that he donated an enormous amount of money to politicians. He was one of the Democrats' biggest donor in 2020, and his colleague had donated a ton of money to the Republicans. He was spending all this time on Capitol Hill. At a minimum, that felt like a contradictory message, you know, that you're trying to really bend the ear of politicians and kind of the wheels of, you know, steer the wheels of power to meet your, to serve your own ends. That doesn't feel altruistic to me. And so when asked about things like that, he really, I mean, seemed to get very uncomfortable, turned in a seat, twitched, pulled out a fidget spinner. So yeah, there were some tells. I think the biggest reveal was really when he thought the interview was over, and he started kind of slagging off other people in the industry who were pretty important players. So that was the thing that was most chilling, was that he was he could easily switch and flip into kind of, hey, you don't want to look at me, you want to look at these guys, kind of a thing.
Right. That was the end of the interview.
Yeah. Wow. And I thought that was just, you know, crypto is actually a very, very small market for all its talk of decentralization and, you know, global. It's really actually very small because the money has to run through the exchanges, at least somewhat. And so, you know, the handful of people that he talked about there were sort of the most important people in crypto left to immediately kind of cast aspersions on them was such a red flag for me. So like, why would you need to do that if your industry was doing fine, if you were doing fine? It felt manipulative and not particularly sophisticated in its manipulation. So yeah, sadly, even though he presents as this kind of sweet kid from California, there seems to be another side, because, you know, for example, what prosecutors are mad at him, you know, potentially talking to a New York Times reporter and leaking damaging information on one of his colleagues. I mean, that's serious stuff. You know, witness tampering is like a, you know, it's a serious crime. So I think there are two sides to him for sure.
Do you think we're on the cusp of change here, in the sense that, you know, Sam and Alex have been indicted, you've released this book, like, because of who you are and then, you know, again, we've grown up on everything you've done, people in my age bracket are willing to look at it, but now we've got this whole other, the younger generation look at, I don't know if you're across the whole Logan Paul crypto zoo thing, like, he's got a very young audience that seems to just be going very badly for him.
Yes.
Do you think we're on a genuine cusp of, there doesn't seem to be a lot of positivity coming out of that industry of, oh no, that's a crazy actor and the Logan Paul thing's a standoff. Like, it's clear as day, and it's becoming clearer every fucking day.
It's becoming clear every single day. And I mean, the thing with a Ponzi is it always falls apart eventually, because there is no there. There's nothing underneath it ultimately. And that's what you see with crypto, is that it gets sort of, things go parabolically up, you know, as the bubble expands and grows massive, but then they crash just as quickly. And I think the narrative is crashing into the reality here. And you know, unfortunately, there's a time lag with regulators and law enforcement. It takes a good while to build cases, to, you know, to gather evidence, to interview potential witnesses, to have, you know, people who work at these companies end up cooperating with the government against their former employees at times. This doesn't happen overnight. But at this point, given sort of where we are macroeconomically with the easy money going away and the Fed raising interest rates, but also with the narrative just crashing into the reality and having sort of impoverished so many people, like so many people having lost money at this point, I think that all signs point to more trouble ahead. And I do think, you know, it's interesting when you point out like they're fighting with each other and there's a lot of negativity in the space. That was one of the things that was so, I mean, I hate to say it, but in a way satisfying, is like all of these guys, they all actually hate each other. Like yeah. They're not, it's not a form of a community. I mean, I'm not saying the regular people, I'm saying amongst the hierarchy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, it's such a cutthroat business. Like they're all, you know, they're in business with each other, but it's only to serve their own ends. And then one guy, you know, gets arrested and then he flips on the next guy who flips on the next guy. And, you know, it's just a time-honored, you know, tradition in criminal cases that like you start with a small fish and you work your way up. And so at this point we're at the top or near the top with Sam and Alex. And, you know, the circle is so small at this point I can't predict the future, but there is more to come, and it'll be interesting to see if crypto can survive it.
Yeah, and I know we have to wrap up, and I just want to check before we go, because of what's happening, you know, Sam's trial's in October, I think. Is there going to be a follow-up book? Are you working on a documentary? Could it even become a TV series? Is there a future here for you in this space?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm working on a documentary now because I filmed a lot of these interactions. So I'm working on that with a producer and editor, and really just trying to kind of make it different from the book, you know, so it's something that fits the medium through which it will be expressed, film as opposed to, you know, the written word. And then, yeah, I'm open to all sorts of other things. And people are starting to kind of reach out to have conversations. Obviously, as an actor and a writer, I'm on strike. So I'm not, you know, fully engaging in those things yet. But look, I think the world of crypto is really fascinating. At some point, I would also like to go back to my real job when the strike is over. Because as much as I like talking about crypto, there is a limit and I'm definitely near it. I don't think it'll be out of my life anytime soon.
Well, Ben, thank you so much for coming on, man. It was great to meet you and talk about this bit. Let's do it again, like in October when the trials happen. Let's get an update.
I love it. Let's do it. I'll buy a new green shirt.
No, let's change it up. Let's go red or blue. You know what I mean? Like, don't be stale.
I love it. I love it.
Ben, thank you so much, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Neil.
To watch full episodes of The Plug Podcast, head over to the official YouTube page at theplug.podcast and hit the subscribe button to stay up to date with all of the video content. Follow us on Instagram and TikTok at theplug.podcast for all episode announces, teasers, and giveaways.